Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
A new law that sparked furious debate during the Florida legislative session earlier this year is still drawing flack. At least one part of it is.
There's like 200 elements of this bill, something like that, and we're just arguing on one.
Also this week, we'll find that even though it's been more than a month since Florida was hit by Hurricane Irma, the impacts continue and how some families with preschool kids are still hurting.
It's difficult to tell families when they as well have been out of work that they have to pay.
We'll also ask, should police be forced to tell you that you can refuse to let them search your vehicle after they pull you over? And we'll learn that despite a drop in the state's workers' comp rates, there are still those who'd like the rates lower still. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capital Report. Few folks who followed the happenings during this year's Florida legislative session could miss all the controversy surrounding the sweeping education measure called House Bill 7069. Despite all the controversy, that bill went on to become law. More than a dozen school districts are now challenging that part of the law that requires them to share their school construction money with charter schools. But as Lynn Hatter reports, some of those same districts are also getting a portion of the extra funding the new law provides.
13 Florida school districts filed suit recently on House Bill 7069. At issue are multiple parts of the bill they claim are unconstitutional. The measure is wide-ranging, and the suing districts have taken issue with language requiring them to steer more federal funding directly to privately run charter schools. Those schools are also given a financial incentive to set up shop near low-performing traditional ones, and they could also get leeway to operate as a district within a district. But one of the bigger complaints against the law is a provision making school districts share their local construction dollars with the charters.
When, you know, local dollars that are collected are forced to be shared, particularly after, you know, we just went through a 10-year capital program. We just passed a half-cent sales tax. We've got all of our work out ahead of us. And then, you know, now we're looking at losing $250 million over that 10-year period. It's troublesome.
That's Palm Beach County Superintendent Robert Avosa in an interview with the Tampa Bay Times' Gradebook blog. His district is also suing over the law, but its challenge is separate and narrowed only to the local revenue issue. Still, he says,
I don't know if I have the number right, but there's like 200 elements of this bill, something like that. And we're just arguing on one, which is the forced distribution of these dollars. There are lots of good things in there. We believe that if they want competition they'll have.
As 14 districts move forward with their lawsuits, some including Palm Beach also requested funding offered up by the bill. Bay County in North Florida, along with Palm Beach, recently got dollars under the Schools of Hope provision. That part of the measure gives up to $2,000 per student to lift perpetually failing schools. The Florida Department of Education received 57 applications for the grant and could have issued awards up to 25 schools, but Education Commissioner Pam Stewart decided on 11. She says she based her decision on the likelihood of success.
And it is these 11, based on the review and as I look at them, that I feel confident in their ability to have success with this up to an additional $2,000 per student.
That means there are still 14 slots available. Stewart says schools that did not get the money can reapply.
We will reopen the application process and we will allow those schools that meet the criteria to apply, and we will be announcing those dates very soon of when those applications should come to us, and then we would come back before the board.
Still, the conflict between schools asking for dollars under the law while suing over it remains a point of frustration for its biggest champion, House Speaker Richard Corcoran. He has accused districts like Bay and Palm Beach of being hypocritical. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
After Hurricane Irma hit Florida last month, many schools were out for days and even longer than that in the Keys. That also meant preschools, including child care centers that serve newborn babies and toddlers, were also closed. From member station WLRN in Miami, Nadege Green tells us the economic toll on preschools after a storm affects families and the people who take care of their children.
I finished my work already.
You finished your journal?
Latoya Williams is reviewing the lesson for the day at the XL Kids Academy in Miami Gardens.
Who can tell me what was our journal topic today? Nikia?
My favorite animal was a flamingo.
What did you like about the flamingo?
It was pink and it's cute.
It's been a few weeks since Hurricane Irma hit. Williams missed 7 days of work because of the storm. The school was closed. She also missed her students.
Personally, I don't have any children, you know, so these are my babies.
She was also concerned about not getting paid for those days.
It'd have been tight.
Williams is an hourly employee, and that would have meant losing half of her paycheck.
Yeah, I have no supplement income, so what I make here is what I make.
But her boss, Chantravia Pointville, did pay her, and all of the other teachers.
It was actually more than just a week of pay that they would miss. The wake of Irma, in addition to the closures following Irma, half check or a whole check could mean homelessness almost. And I wanted to make sure that that did not happen to the staff.
When a storm hits, hourly employees in early childcare and other jobs can face economic hardships that last a long time. If they don't go to work, they typically don't get paid. Pointville says that additional layer of financial stress is especially unhelpful when you need to focus on taking care of children.
The caregivers have to be stable themselves in order to care for anyone else. I believe that if the staff was financially stable, they would recover from the emotional and material loss with less stress.
And it's not just the people who work at the child care centers. Many of the families who bring in their kids are also hourly employees who didn't get paid for days missed because of Hurricane Irma. Most preschools charge a flat rate, whether or not your child shows up for school. After Hurricane Irma, Pointville and some other preschool providers waived that rule. Parents did not have to pay for the time the school was closed. And for parents who were still struggling after they reopened, some offered discounted rates or payment plans. Rocio Leba runs the ABF Learning Center in Homestead. That's what she did.
It's difficult to tell families when they as well have been out of work that they have to pay.
Her preschool serves an army base and a homeless shelter nearby. She says when we talk about how hurricanes impact schools, preschools are rarely part of that conversation.
Everybody focused on, you know, Dade County Public Schools or schools going to be open in that sense. But I think for the younger years and the child care centers and such, probably not as important.
And I don't think we have been, as a community and as you know, even with government, responsive enough to the needs of preschools.
Evelio Torres is CEO of the Early Learning Coalition of Miami-Dade and Monroe Counties. He says preschool owners have created their own systems to help families and their employees after a storm. But he says community-wide, there has to be more help for hourly employees after a hurricane.
Typical response of asking people to apply for FEMA is great, but it doesn't really address the immediate need. And that's what we have to get a lot better at doing, addressing the immediate needs.
It's three, look, one, two, three.
At the XL Kids Academy in Miami Gardens, Miss Williams is watching over her kids as they work on computers. She says she's happy to be back with them.
And when I go to the store, you know, I'm always thinking about them. I know, it's just those little things like that brings me joy.
And she's happy she got her full paycheck after Hurricane Irma. I'm Nadege Green in Miami.
Florida's jobless rate dropped 0.2 percentage point in September to 3.8%. That happened even though the number of people with jobs fell by 42,000 from August. Governor Rick Scott attributed the drop in the state's unemployment rate to Hurricane Irma, that massive storm that swept throughout the state last month. The estimated figures posted today by the Department of Economic Opportunity also stripped Monroe County, still reeling from the powerful storm that made initial landfall in the Keys on September 10th, of its long-held position of the state's lowest jobless mark. Monroe County saw its unemployment mark grow to 3.3%. That's up from 2.7% in August. Okaloosa and St. John's counties now hold the mark for the lowest jobless rate, both at 2.7%, while rural Hendry County, which was entering the citrus growing season, is the highest at 8.6%. Still to come on Capitol Report, declining claims are driving workers' comp rates lower, but some labor groups argue the rate should be lower still.
The claim frequency has been a trend for the entire 21st century.
How well do you know your rights? What about the right to bar law enforcement officers from conducting a search in certain cases?
If I get pulled over and I've done nothing wrong and someone asks to search my car, no, because I have a right to be left alone and I don't want you searching my car.
Utility experts are looking into what the growth in the electric car industry could mean for them.
You know, electric transportation is coming. I don't think it's a question of if, but more about when and how quickly.
And Florida's archaeologists are struggling to manage all of the state's underwater historic resources, so they're getting some help from amateur scuba divers.
So this is real-world needed work that archaeologists can't get to because we're tasked with doing 9,000 other things.
Say the words workers' comp, and unless you're an employer, most folks' eyes either glaze over or show profound confusion. But for those folks who have other people working for them, workers' comp rates are a pretty big deal and a rather significant cost of doing business. After spiking last year, workers' compensation rates in Florida are set to decline. But Nick Evans reports some labor organizations contend the decrease doesn't go far enough.
Last year, the National Council on Compensation Insurance made a startling announcement. Workers' comp rates needed to jump by almost 20%. It was concerned about two court cases, scrapping attorney fee provisions in state law. In the end, state regulators approved a modified request, increasing rates by about 14% instead. Now, the same organization says rates can come down, this time by about 9%. NCCI Executive Jeff Ettinger explains the change.
Specifically, claim frequency is down more than 8% in the last 2 years. And this is really the major driver behind the proposed rate decrease.
NCCI Senior Actuary Jay Rosen suggests claims are dropping because employers are making safer working environments a priority.
I think the contributing factors are a number. Safer workplaces, enhanced efficiencies in the workplace, increased use of automation in the workplace, innovative technologies that have been implemented in the workplace have all combined to reduce the number of workplace injuries.
But Mark Toby, with Florida Workers Advocates, pushes back on NCCI's explanation.
The claim frequency has been a trend for the entire 21st century. From 2000, it has been with, you know, little hiccup here and there due to the Great Recession. The claim frequency has been pretty consistently going down.
The labor organization he represents argues the proposed 9.3% reduction in rates doesn't go far enough. Actuary Stephen Alexander says a 15.4% reduction makes more sense.
I recommend that you approve a 15.4% rate decrease for industrial classifications based upon a targeted underwriting loss of 4%, which is consistent with what the experience has been in other NCCI states.
Alexander argues a projected loss is okay because insurance companies will make up for the shortfall through investment returns. Put simply, companies invest the money they collect from premiums, and those holdings begin generating income. Even though the company will eventually pay out slightly more than it originally collected, the returns those investments generated more than make up for the loss. It might sound precarious, but Alexander explains in other states, insurers were able to generate 18% pre-tax returns.
And you compare that to Florida, and Florida was about 26%. And that resulted in an excess profit of $1.8 billion.
Alexander argues that return might be great for insurers and their shareholders, but it's a drag on the Florida economy. State regulators are crunching the numbers, and they'll make an order on rates soon. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You haven't done anything wrong, but you're pulled over anyway. The law enforcement officer asks to search your car. Should that officer be required to tell you about your right to decline the search? As Sasha Cordner reports, Florida lawmakers have started discussions about that very topic for the 2018 legislative session.
Under current law, there are circumstances where law enforcement officers are able to conduct a search without a warrant.
For example, where an officer is in fear of his safety, if he believes that there may be a weapon present that could harm him, if he's in imminent harm, if he feels or she feels that there is evidence that may be destroyed if the search is not conducted immediately. Those are already allowed under the law without consent.
But Fort Lauderdale Democratic Senator Gary Farmer asks, what about situations where officers require the person's consent, yet they don't have it? And do people know they have the right to decline a search in those cases?
One would think that most people are aware of these rights, but numerous studies have been conducted which show that an individual, when approached by a law enforcement officer in uniform, is essentially a bit intimidated, and they don't really fully understand that they have the ability to say no to that search.
One such study came from a Department of Justice study from a few years ago.
Of all the searches that were done, 50% of the searches were consensual, as opposed to a warrant search or as opposed to an emergency exigent circumstance search. But of those 50%, 78% of the people reported believing that they could not refuse the search and that they thought the search was illegitimate. I got pulled over for a burnt out taillight. Now I'm getting searched for something that's much more significant than that. And so that shows that we have a problem where citizens just simply aren't aware of what the law is.
So Farmer says he filed a bill to remedy that.
Senate Bill 262 would establish a requirement that law enforcement officers advise officials of their rights, particularly that they are able to refuse a consent of their vehicle.
Still, his measure has received some pushback from lawmakers like Senator Dennis Baxley. The Ocala Republican says instead of creating a legislative fix, he feels the bill is creating a problem and places an added burden on law enforcement.
And this just doesn't go in the direction of the message that I want to give to those who are out there on the front line. And instead, well, you've got these law enforcement constantly being reviewed and questioned, internal investigation. Why did you pull this guy over? Why did that? You can't follow your instincts anymore as a law enforcement. You sense that something's wrong and you investigate it. And this goes with that sentiment that says it's your duty to inform them they don't have to cooperate with you. Why should I tell anybody they don't have to cooperate with me? I don't get that.
But Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley disagrees that the bill is negative toward law enforcement. Still, Bradley says he doesn't believe it should be up to the legislature to decide such an issue. In addition, he cited the exclusionary rule that's already in place in the U.S. The legal rule essentially states evidence collected in violation of a person's constitutional rights is inadmissible in court.
I love law enforcement, and I think these should be a part of the protocols, but I just don't want to codify it. And I see where you're coming from with this, and I think people have a right to be left alone if they want to be.
St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis says he too is conflicted about the bill, but he says he would lean more toward passing the bill if some changes were made.
Standardize the language, just like we have with Miranda rights, to remain silent, to make sure that there is some standardized language as to what officers must say or should say in these in regards to search of papers and effects and property.
Meanwhile, as for the bill sponsor, Senator Farmer, he says his goal is making sure Floridians' rights are enforced, not letting criminals get away with committing crimes. And he says he intends to work on addressing the concerns expressed by lawmakers before it comes back up again for another hearing in its first committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
It just seems as though we can't get away from storm stories. Tim Padgett traveled from Florida to Guayama in Puerto Rico's hard-hit southeast to find out how residents there are recovering.
A full month after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, 80% of its 3.5 million people still have no power, and relief supplies are only now starting to move more regularly into the island's demolished interior. Still, President Trump gave his performance there a perfect 10.
No, para mí no.
But on the streets of Puerto Rico itself, it was hard to find anyone who agreed with him. Ana Rivera is a San Juan maintenance worker. What performance, Rivera asked? How can you grade work you haven't really done? Down in Guayama, in Puerto Rico's hard-hit southeast, Albert Rodriguez waited in a long line for hard-to-find cash. He also gave Trump a lower mark.
He's doing a horrible job. It's just real slow, very slow. I just think he doesn't think that we're important at all. Puerto Ricans are American citizens, and they should start treating us as such.
At the White House, Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló told reporters the president, quote, responded immediately to the island's crisis. I'm Tim Padgett in Guayama.
As more electric vehicles begin showing up on Florida's streets, the state's utilities and utility regulators are looking into what impact the cars could have on the state's electric infrastructure. Regan McCarthy has more.
Last time her board looked at the issue, Public Service Chair Julie Emanuel Brown says electric cars weren't prevalent enough to warrant much attention. And the commission sent a report to the legislature saying just that.
It ultimately concluded that new challenges that EVs would pose to the electric grid were not likely to emerge until beyond the 10-year planning horizon.
But that could be changing. Electric vehicles are growing in popularity so much so that Kellen Schefter, with the investor-owned utility trade group Edison Electric Institute, says electric vehicles have become a given.
You know, electric transportation is coming. I don't think it's a question of if, but more about when and how quickly.
One part of supporting that growth is installing more charging stations throughout the state to increase accessibility. Experts say right now a limited number of places where people can charge their cars is a major barrier to widespread adoption of electric vehicles. And Schefter points out that responsibility likely can't be left to car companies alone.
The chargers that are going out there today, driven by Tesla, driven by potentially Electrify America, others, they're going to go where they want to. They need to have the chargers to sell cars, right? I think there's an important role we can play thinking about how does everybody have access to these charging stations, to the technology. There's going to be gaps when you look at kind of these maps, and I think electric companies can help fill those in and make sure everybody has access.
At the same time, utilities will also need to prepare for the potential increase in power being drawn from the grid as more drivers charge their cars. That could involve scheduling power draws for a time when the grid is not at peak use. Britta Gross is the general manager of Advanced Vehicle Commercialization Policy. She says car manufacturers are developing methods for controlling when vehicles draw power from the electric grid.
We are in the process now of commercializing these apps on the vehicle so that signals from utilities could then just go right into OnStar and command their customers' vehicles to do whatever they've signed up to do, probably for a little bit of pocket change in their willingness to cooperate with the utility and charge when they say it's good and not charge when it's not so good.
Meanwhile, utilities say they're already taking electric vehicles into account in their planning, and lawmakers are looking for ways to incentivize local governments to support needed changes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida's coastlines and cavern systems are dotted with historic sites from World War II-era shipwrecks to Spanish galleons to remnants of thousand-year-old civilizations. But there aren't enough archaeologists to keep up with the underwater preservation. Kate Payne reports how the state is training amateur scuba divers to pick up some of the slack.
Della Scott Ireton is on a mission to teach Floridians what underwater archaeology is.
Well, archaeology itself is not the study of dinosaurs.
She helps run the Florida Public Archaeology Network, where she trains volunteers in marine preservation.
Just like our colleagues on land, we lay out square grids underwater. We use PVC. We excavate in layers, just like our colleagues on land, and take very careful notes and recordings.
She's giving a room full of hobbyist scuba divers a crash course in monitoring underwater historic sites It's part of the Submerged Sites Education and Archaeological Stewardship Program, or SEAS. She says non-disturbance is key.
We're not going to be disturbing the bottom sediments. We won't be excavating. We're going to be recording what is ever sticking up above the sea floor. And so there's really easy ways to do that, and that's always the first thing archaeologists do on any shipwreck site, to figure out what is there. What's the bow? What's the stern? How big is it?
Florida has 12 designated shipwreck preserves, sort of underwater state parks, as well as many historic structures and archaeological sites, thousands of which are threatened by sea level rise.
So this is real-world needed work that archaeologists can't get to because we're tasked with doing 9,000 other things.
The ships need monitoring for littering and looting, plaques need cleaning, and research teams need volunteers to measure and document sites.
And so if we hear about something that uncovers on the beach or in the water, we get a report. I may not be able to get to Bradenton Beach tomorrow, but I know who I can call in Bradenton and say, grab the SEAS divers and go check this out for me. And so that's what I'm hoping we can do with you all as well.
The next step is for the students to test out their knowledge. The archaeologists-to-be are taking turns swimming to the bottom of a backyard pool to measure artifacts in full scuba gear. Archaeologist Nicole Grenan guides them through.
I think what we're doing with this is not necessarily getting detailed scientific drawings of the site. It's mostly to get an idea of the extent of the site, any major artifact features or features of the shipwreck, enough so that we can put it in something like the Florida Master Site file or update our records. So that
today, the artifacts are store-bought pots, but there's a lot to practice, gearing up, writing underwater on special paper, and using sign language to communicate. Maritime archaeologists just have more to think about.
You have to worry about the barracudas, sharks, different other stuff, but that's fun.
Corrections officer Dennis Pumphrey is hooked.
There's just so much history all over the place, and being able to get to it's neat.
He and his wife, Sally Cole Pumphrey, already have their next scuba trips planned out.
Thousands of spots. I want to check that. There's a old graveyard that's in a lake, Chocassee. I want to dive it. Figuring out how to do the charcoal underwater is going to be interesting.
Looting can be an issue with all archaeological sites, but especially with shipwrecks. Part of what appeals to Sally Cole Pumphrey is the idea of preserving the history and leaving the objects behind for future visitors and researchers.
As far as the dating, you might be able to tell from the pottery itself, but as far as the location for the relative dating, and when you take it out of context like that without documenting it, you lose that. You know, now, okay, yeah, you've got a neat little thing to look at, but historically, you have nothing.
After this training, the Pumphreys will be qualified to support research teams. They plan to get involved with future dives along the Osceola River. The last big find in the area, a 14,500-year-old knife from one of the earliest civilizations in North America. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport, and join us next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.